Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. And for over 20 years, our guest, Bob Siegel, has provided dedicated legal services to clients in entertainment and general media, specializing in independent film and television and fiction and nonfiction projects at all stages from development through distribution of rights. And Bob is also a donor to your Roy Dean Grant program, right, Carol?
Yes, Claire. Bob's one of the few donors who contacted me saying that he would really like to be part of our grant. And so thank you very much, Bob, for that opportunity and also for joining us today.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Hello, Claire. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Well, I'm teaching some wonderful filmmakers in a new class called Intentional Filmmaking, and they kept coming up with some very important questions, and that's why I asked if we could do this show so that we could answer a lot of these questions together. So the first question they have is, in the many stages of production, which tasks require a lawyer's help?
Well, you have to take a look at what exactly, what services need to be provided, and there are a variety of them. I mean, there are different phases. One is the financing phase, and if it's a donations and you're dealing with a fiscal sponsor, and there's no expectation of return on the monetary contribution, that's relatively straightforward. But when you start dealing with investors who actually are putting money into projects and they expect some kind of return, then we have to deal with drafting of financing documents and, of course, the various exemptions and issues that have been raised in the past regarding securities. And I said, more importantly, the exemptions, because that's how you basically don't make it that expensive. Also, if you're dealing with licenses, pre-sales because of a certain topic, those agreements also will have to be negotiated. And a lot of times, nonfiction projects especially are kind of this crazy quilt of financing, of donations and investment and maybe some loans. And also there might be some money that comes from like public TV, or if a deal is made with a particular cable station in advance. A lot of times they want to see the project beforehand. But that's one factor. The other is the production, and a lot of it is, again, the usual releases and location, releases, et cetera. There might be a life story agreement if it's a main subject. And also the agreements between the people working on the project, the director, the producer, the crew, and all of that. And that all has to be dealt with. And also if you're securing, licensing rights for pre-existing music, try to get a music supervisor if possible, because it's not very efficient to have an attorney do all the licenses, because a lot of it is just follow-up work. But those licenses do have to be drafted if it's not provided by the licensor of a composition or recording. And then, obviously, the issues of distribution, getting the film into the marketplace. So there, optimally, it's best to start at the very beginning, you know, as soon as people take money or form relationships or in connection with the project, rather than to kind of come in later and have to kind of play catch up.
So when they start to form relationships, let's say that they hire a director or hire an editor, you think it's always good to get started with some kind of a written agreement that you get whatever, right?
Well, definitely, because if you're hiring someone, the most important concept is that everything that they're working on, the results and proceeds of what they work on are actually owned by the production company on a, say, a work-for-hire basis, because otherwise they would have ownership of what they create, and obviously that is obviously very problematical. And that's why everyone really should, you know, who's involved in the production should be signing off on such a, you know, on such a document.
Well, this brings up a question, another question that on chain of title, because this is, as soon as you start your film, you have to collect everything that has to do with the chain of title, right?
Well, chain of title is, you know, it becomes a little more complicated in a fictional work because, you know, you may have hired the writer or you may have optioned and purchased the rights to a screenplay. In the case of a documentary, there really isn't a screenplay unless one is being written for the program, hopefully on a work-for-hire basis. If, you know, if you were dealing with issues of life rights, again, why do people get life rights agreements? Do they need them absolutely? I mean, it's not really, you know, do or die. However, the most important reasons for it is, one, to get a waiver or a release from any claims a subject may make. Also, to keep them involved in the project, not to go to any other. So that's another, you know, agreement that it's not really part of the chain of title per se, because, again, we don't have a screenplay that we register with the Copyright Office. However, at the very end, obviously there's going to be a documentary, and that should be filed with the Copyright Office. And again, making sure that, especially for music or any pre-existing materials in the project, that there are, you know, clearances for use in the documentary itself, you know, again, throughout the world, the universe, and in all different variety of media and promotion and advertising. So the documentation is required, but it's not, you know, a chain of title per se, like screenplay, produced film, et cetera. But it's still something, and of course, you know, there may be a request to make sure there's, regarding the title. Again, has the title been used? How has it been used before? Is there a likelihood to cause confusion? And again, there could be a copyright search, but probably that's not going to be as effective unless it just indicates projects that have the same title. So obviously, for documentaries, it's not as stringent, but still as important in terms of getting the releases and the and the licenses for the project.
Well, Bob, I'd like to ask, how much should an indie filmmaker budget for legal fees when it comes to, you know, the overall budget?
Well, I mean, when you deal in the fiction world, particularly at a certain budget level, you know, like over $1 million or so, sometimes you can say like 1% to 2% of the budget. The problem is when you get into these ultra-low budget projects and it's like, say, $100,000, 1% to 2% is $1,000 or $2,000, and that's not going to really work. And people tend to forget that the work that you do for a $50,000 project or a $100,000, quarter of a million, or a $500,000 project is basically the same. It's just it's at a lower amount. So I think you have to look at how the project is financed. You know, are there a lot of producers and their relationships on the project? Also, again, in terms of the subject matter, if it's going to deal with issues regarding a subject that might lead to claims of defamation. Also, there's a lot of, it's a music documentary and clearances of music. Also, the people involved in the project, how much experience, have they worked on other projects? So this all kind of works into the mix. And again, part of it, depends on the funding and then the actual production of the project and maybe the distribution, later on. So it's very much a facts and circumstance type of position. Like to say, oh, yeah, it's $250,000, it's $10,000. I mean, it could be. But or it could be five or whatever. Again, a lot of this also depends. Just as there are many factors, and and again, when you sign up to work on a project, you tend to work on it for a good period of time because there's a lot, getting that project out in the public into the marketplace can take months and sometimes even years. So it has to be really, you have to talk to each particular documentarian and in order to really get a good sense.
Okay.
Thank you.
When a filmmaker is looking to hire an attorney, what should they look for?
Well, they should look for an attorney who has experience in that particular area. In this case, it's not just entertainment law, and it's not necessarily just motion pictures or television, it's documentaries, which is, it's kind of a specialized area, or at the very least somebody that does deal with film and television. I mean, you wouldn't want to get a music attorney, say, to serve, as production counsel. I mean, there may be a need maybe for a music attorney if it's a complicated music documentary, it's really, what projects has the attorney worked on, and also it's not just the understanding of the law, it's the understanding of the industry, which, has changed more and more, especially as we move into digital distribution. So I think, you have to get some recommendations and then basically speak with the potential attorneys and also what type of vibe or sense do they do, because they're going to be working together for quite a while.
I think that's the truth. And one thing I always love is that attorneys do give you 10, 15 minute free consultation, so you can check them out and see if you like them or not. I've found that to be very helpful. When I ran my film company, I had several attorneys because, Bob, I had one who was a New York attorney who helped me collect debt. Mm-hmm. He collected debt for the gambling casinos in Vegas, so he specialized in that. And then there was the corporate attorney, and then I had to create a non-disclosure agreement, and he was another attorney. So sometimes it was the best part of it was looking for an attorney, was doing the consultations, and you would know in 15 or 20 minutes if that was the person you wanted to really trust with your business.
Yeah, definitely that is the case. Hopefully you're not getting conflicting information or that could be a problem. Hopefully, everybody's kind of saying the same thing more or less. That's really that's one of the ways that you find out, and eventually, it's almost like, are we going to go out and start dating or not? So it's one of those situations where, you can have, courting to a certain point, and then we have to kind of fish or cut bait.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Well, Bob, if a filmmaker has a limited budget and there are certain legal requirements that they can actually get away with doing themselves or through sites like LegalZoom, etc., what do you think about that?
Well, I think people should realize attorneys don't really make a lot of money off the formation of limited liability companies or corporations. I mean, these are really, you know, basically they have to be, you know, formed, and basically there has to be the appropriate documentation. And a lot of online services, you know, they'll go up to the state capitol, the Secretary of State, and they'll get basically, you know, a filing receipt. But will they, you know, and a kind of a boilerplate articles of organization or a certificate of formation? You know, and that's one thing that could be done. Although, again, I don't know what exactly, you know, you might be getting. As I said, you might have someone just filing on your behalf the same way an attorney would. And, you know, and basically you might be saving, you know, it might be a few $100 here or there. You know, you have to consider whether or not, you know, it's just kind of a little bit penny wise, pound foolish, you know, so to speak. You know, because are you going to really save a significant amount of money in that case, as opposed to just starting working with an attorney to form the entity? Because it's going to lead to other, you know, other issues, and eventually there's going to have to, you know, if you're going to be dealing with investors, or even not, there's still going to have to be an operating agreement drafted, even if it's, which deals with the rights and responsibilities of the people in the LL limited liability company, you know, whether they're managers or they're members, or they could be both, frequently they are, and that no online service is going to provide for you.
Right. So, and you have to sit and review it anyway, whatever they buy.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe make changes or additions, so.
Right, and, you know, in a lot of ways, you don't want to reinvent the wheel, and you think you saved money, but then it has to be rewritten, and then any of the perceived cost savings kind of evaporate. But I think the real area where there are savings is when it comes to, again, getting the releases, getting the location agreements, working with a music supervisor, if it's a music-heavy film, pre-existing music, and working with the attorney, you know, that can provide, you know, licenses for the synchronization, which is for the actual composition, and the master, which is for the recording. And I think that's the area where you can kind of be relatively efficient. And that's something that obviously should be discussed by a client with the attorney in advance, not after the fact, hopefully.
Okay. Well, another question from a filmmaker is, if I shoot in a foreign country with a small, high-definition consumer camera and no crew, and use some of that footage, maybe even just as an A-roll or B-roll, would I have any problems if I didn't get permits?
Well, the issue of permits, I mean, again, public property versus private property. Private property, obviously, you should get a location release for. If it's out in the street, there's less of an expectation of privacy. There isn't someone's claim that this is public property. Again, the fact where you're shooting, there are certain concepts that are going to carry over. Like, if someone's going to appear recognizably on camera, regardless of where they're from and where you're shooting them, so to speak, you're still going to have to get a release. And that sometimes means you're going to have to get a release translated into a different language, which has happened quite a bit. And you just try to keep it, if you know, to the essential. The essential rights that need to be secured, and I've dealt with that issue for people, whether it's, you know, in the Middle East or it's in Mexico or what have you, or France or, you know, or Germany. In an ideal world, you know, you try to get your releases and your location agreements in place, because that will assure the distributors and the sales agents and the licensees who are going to acquire, you know, license the rights to the projects with a certain degree of security, especially when you want to get what's called errors and omission insurance. which is insurance that if there is some kind of claim that's brought for defamation or copyright infringement, so forth. But to do that, you have to really try to get the paperwork in order as the best as possible.
Well, what about, I've seen people that put up a sign that says, we are filming in this location. If you walk in this area, you give us the permission to photograph you.
That has been the case. That works like with stadiums or in audiences for events, you know, like baseball games, and you know, and that can be done when people are going to be in a particular area, and you always have to make sure that wherever there's a potential entrance, that there is a sign and it's clear and people can see it and not just walk on by it. So it's, you know, it's there, it's visible, and people know it's there, and then it's up to them whether or not they want to come in. You know, again, when it comes to, like, baseball games, the irony is that type of release is not in front of all the entrances. It's actually on the back of your ticket. And, you know, you can raise a question, do people really have the ability to negotiate if it's on the back of your ticket? Well, you don't have to go to the ball game. You know, it's your choice. So there are times when that can be, you know, can be used, especially when you're dealing with crowd situations.
Okay. But basically you're saying that if she's in a foreign country and she's shooting people on the street, then without their approval, she could be in trouble. She needs to have a release if she gets people in the scenes, right?
Right, because the question may come down the road, like you know, basically with a distributor, and they're going to say, well, you know, and it's going to appear in the application, we get errors and omission insurance. Have releases been secured for all people who are recognizable on camera? Yes, or if no, explain why. And if you explain why, you know, they may, you know, have an issue, and they may not want to cover that particular, you know, particular interview with an insurance underwriter. May not want to cover that. And the problem is that the, you know, distributors and sales agents, they don't want Swiss cheese errors and omission policies where there are exclusions and exemptions. They want to be able to do it. So that's the reason why you make your best efforts to secure such, you know, releases and paperwork as much as you can.
Okay. Well, this same filmmaker is saying, if I use my own children in a documentary to get interviews, do I have to have work permits for them if it was in the summer?
It's an interesting question, because you have to realize if this is a documentary, they're not portraying another role. They're basically acting as themselves, so a release is sufficient. Actually, I had a situation where there was an expert doctor in the documentary who was actually a member of, at the time it was AFTRA, you know, one of the actors' associations, as well as SAG. And the question came up, like, do we need to, you know, basically pay her? And I said, no, she's not acting in a role, and she's not appearing, you know, on a talk show. This is a documentary. So basically, it's a, you know, it was, you know, a release was perfectly sufficient. And that should be, you know, unless your children are playing roles and it's a reenactment or something like that, or reenactment, you know, that's a whole different matter.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, this is a twofold question. And what I'm wanting to know is, on a small, low-key production, do filmmakers need to have production insurance? And also, when is it appropriate to get production insurance on stealth projects?
Well, regardless of whether they're, you know, really below the radar or not, it's all a question of risk assessment. And, you know, again, it used to be more of an issue when you rented cameras rather than you owned your own cameras. Or if you, like, get a director of photography and they have their own camera, do they have their own insurance? If not, you know, it will be, you know, an issue to address, because what happens, God forbid, if any equipment is damaged that the production doesn't own, or even if the production owns and wants to have it replaced. And again, when it comes, you know, to injuries, you know, I know workers' compensation may seem, you know, you're running a business, even though it's a skeletal below the radar business. Now, if you don't do it, no one's going to put a gun to a documentarian's head and say, comply or die. But you have to realize there are potential risks, you know, if basically somebody trips over a cable. And I guess the difference is it somebody working on the project, it's workman's comp. If it's someone that's outside that of working on the project, then it's a third-party injury. And so you have to really, you know, a lot of it, you have to really give it considerable thought and, you know, see whether or not you want to, again, take the risk.
Right. Well, let me ask you about Dubai and Russia. This one filmmaker is going there, and she's wondering if she will have problems shooting in the countryside, talking to regular country folks on camera. She says, could they confiscate my cameras or my footage?
Well, again, if you're out on the countryside, I said the likelihood of someone, you know, someone from the government, you know, tracking you down or seeing you is somewhat remote. I think also a lot of this has to do with preparation, especially if you're not going to be in the countryside and you're going to be in the city. And if there can be, especially if you can, if a documentarian can secure the assistance of somebody who's local, maybe local in terms of, you know, in the documentary industry or in media industry, to help kind of pave the way so that, you know, you might have a better understanding of the kind of the nuances of the culture, if you can do that. If not, then obviously you try to be discreet. And obviously, if you have your big camera and you're in the middle of the square, it's a separate type of situation. Again, depending on, you know, on the regime, sometimes it's a lot more flexible. Also, you know, a documentarian can take a look at other projects that have been in that particular area, look at the credits, and maybe contact the producers or documentarians and maybe get, you know, some kind of insight if it happened recently and not, you know, a long time ago.
Okay, that's a real good idea. How do we protect from stealing our film or copyright in foreign countries? Is there any law that protects filmmakers when they have created a product and other people take it and show it in foreign countries?
Well, this goes back to the issue of copyright, and there are various, you know, each country has their own or some variation of copyright law, almost all the countries. A lot of them belong to, you know, a confederation like the Berne Convention, where you have to accord reciprocal treatment for works that are outside your country as in your country if you're going to give them the same treatment. And then the question is, it's the question of enforceability. Again, you know, it used to be like in Russia or especially, you know, in China, it was like the Wild West, and, you know, it still is, the Far East in terms of enforcement. But they do have the laws on the book, in their legislation. Again, there's always the question of, you know, how you can enforce it, especially if something is happening outside the United States. I mean, are you going to get local counsel, you know, in a particular area, you know, the cost-benefit analysis? And you have to remember, especially when it comes to the issues of documentaries, it's the expression of the documentary, not the idea, that is protectable. I mean, if somebody wants to do work on a similar idea having to do with religious intolerance in a particular area, obviously that's not copyrightable. So when it comes to nonfiction works, especially documentaries, sometimes you'll see different, you know, you'll see the same subject matter covered in a variety of ways. You know, you try to go to subjects, maybe you can in the releases, you know, indicate that they, you know, won't speak to someone on a competing project for a certain period of time, but that's a matter of negotiation. Or you basically realize that, you know, hey, ideas are out there, and, you know, it isn't, the ideas are one thing, but how well they're executed and produced is going to be a whole separate issue. So, I think, you know, as I said, if you were dealing with one subject, and that subject basically, or a few, or a handful of subjects, and somebody wants to do a competing project, then I think that's maybe more of a potential issue than, say, copyright infringement. And then, of course, you know, if it's going to wind up on BitTorrent, even though they're trying to clean up their act, you know, it's very hard, outside of having a takedown notice sent out to various sites, and hopefully if they're using an internet service provider, they will attempt to help police it, even though, you know, they're not going to be held responsible if they fail to do so.
Okay, those are good suggestions. Thank
yes,
you.
Thank you. Well, now, this is just a little bit different, though, and that is when it comes to, you know, the whole new distributional media world. When someone uses a cut from a filmmaker's film in their own film to make money, and then they don't have the rights for it, is there a recourse of some kind that, I mean, and we're just talking about cuts from a film rather than the whole foreign issue.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting situation because, again, you know, you could, you know, as a documentarian or any type of media maker, you could be on either side of the coin. A lot of times, as the documentarian, you want to be able to use in a limited matter for a specific purpose pre-existing material, and hopefully you can get a license, secure the rights for use of it in your project. Otherwise, we'll have to rely on, you know, the concept of fair use, which hopefully we'll get to in a moment, which people have to remember is a defense to copyright infringement. So what may happen is that rather than the documentarian being the one who is trying to secure, trying to include material without necessarily securing rights, the documentarian's own project may be used as material in someone else's project. And the same, it's the same analysis. I mean, whether or not the, you know, that third-party media maker or documentarian, you know, would have a colorable argument of fair use to include it, or are they just basically infringing on your copyright? And then it's the same process of notice and pursuit of, you know, for copyright infringement, which is always a difficult thing to pursue in the courts, unless there's very apparent evidence of infringement. So it's as I said, on one hand, a documentarian may want to rely on that type of concept of, you know, fair use. However, it might be too much of a taking. And I guess this is a good point to get into the issue of fair use, which I said is a defense to the claims of copyright infringement. It means you haven't secured the rights or gotten a license, but you still have the right to use it because you're using it using a small amount. You're not going to adversely affect the owner of the copyright of the work, and it's being used for a purpose other than to pump up the value or the production value in a project. It may be used for the purposes of commentary, such as if you want to show how Los Angeles was depicted in motion pictures, you'd have to use the clips of movies that were set in Los Angeles. Or if you're going to make a movie, produce a documentary about, you know, what used to be called X-rated movies, how else are you going to be able to use these, be able to illustrate the point unless you include it? Again, try to secure the license, try to negotiate it, but if it's being used for what's called a transformative purpose, you know, for purposes of explaining something and not just putting in, you know, cool music and film just because it's going to make your project have a higher production value, then that's the type of analysis that has to be done frequently with an attorney. And there are also, you know, a series of best practices that are available, excuse me, through American University, and you can get that usually online, like through the Independent Documentary Association. But they're really for documentaries that not, and they're not really for fiction, and they're for specific cases so that there can be more of a balance between not having to have your project become cost prohibitive for licensing everything, while on the other hand, not giving adequate compensation if there is the use of pre-existing material in a more than minimal or transformative manner.
Okay.
Wow. All right.
I hope that was clear enough.
Okay. Well, this there's a couple of things here. One of my filmmakers had a film that that information was taken from it and was put up on the internet, and she asked them to take it down, and they did, but then it went viral like a free film. So is there any way she can rein that back in? I mean, it's all over the internet now in various places.
Well, you said information. I assume it wasn't the information that's in the documentary, but it was actually footage from the documentary.
No, footage from the documentary. But
right, and again, if there is a source that's, you know, that is actually has unauthorized manner, you know, distributing it, yes, you contact them or have a takedown notice issued. But once it goes viral, you know, basically it's kind of like how do you prevent the spread of, you know, the flu? You know, it becomes very, very difficult. And that's why I frequently have dealt with clients who have had issues concerning, compromising photos were taken of them, or they did it in the past, they did it for art reasons, things like that, and then it actually wound up like on Gawker. And once it goes there, it's very difficult unless you start calling and basically having, you know, sending, you know, demand letters and so forth. But once it's really, you know, viral, you only can go to the places that actually first transmitted it and try to stop them. But again, that, you know, frequently is too late. And as I said, you only can do what you can. If you can nip it in the bud early, great. If not, you know, you can try to call and see if there are ways that images could be removed, you know, so that they're not accessible, even though they may be taken off the net, you know, the whole Wayback machine type of phenomenon. But that's very difficult to do. Once something's on the internet, you know, it takes a life of its own and hard to rein it back in.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we had a filmmaker who wrote in to ask about this, but it's kind of a long question here. She says that she's completed a documentary on a $50,000 budget, and the main subject of the film now wants to split the gross revenues. So I'm thinking that's 60 for the filmmaker, 40 for the subject. She says that they did not have an existing deal in place, and that's after the issues with one of the original producers. So what she wants to know is, what would be a reasonable deal? The subject is a woman in her 70s who's that the filmmaker has great respect for, but also she desires to be honored as a filmmaker and valued. So, you know, she feels like she's the one, the filmmaker, who took the risk to tell an important story that otherwise wouldn't have been made. So with all that said, what do you feel would be a reasonable deal?
Well, it's an interesting issue regarding the compensation of subjects. And there used to be, it ran a spectrum, and basically the kind of the pure, pristine version was, we don't compensate our subjects, it compromises us as journalists, documentarians, etc. And that is one line that can be taken. And there are various news organizations that don't compensate. And then there's another school of thought on the other end of the spectrum that says, you know, basically, if you as a documentarian are producing a project and you actually, it's successful and it actually generates revenue and you worked with a subject and the subject spent the time with you and actually didn't had to not do other things, is it, you know, is it something that's reasonable, like if you do well, maybe they should basically get a benefit of that as well? And more and more situations, there is that type of business, and it is tricky, and it is a slippery slope. But again, the idea is if you can structure this compensation arrangement out of profits, rather than paying them out of the budget, that's of course most preferable, because if you do well, they would do well, and there would be maybe a certain percentage. You know, and it could be whatever is negotiable. A lot of times I've worked on projects dealing with, musical bands. And for one project, you know, we had to basically deal with that because they were providing a lot of things, including materials, access to materials, et cetera. And it's really a matter of negotiation, whether or not you want to make it, you know, whatever number, 10%, 25%, whatever. And then the more important issue is to decide how it's defined. Is it money off the top, you know, as it comes into you, or is it after there's recoupment of any of expenses, or if there's a recoupment for an investor, which, you know, isn't off the top. It's what's more like a net participation. Now, projects that are funded totally by donations are great because there's no one to repay. But there might be, you know, an investor involved or a lender involved in the project. Excuse me. And then you have to really make the decision, are you willing to pay them off the top because it's easier for purposes of accounting, or basically if they're going to be getting some kind of profit participation, it should be on the same basis as you, and you're not going to start seeing profits until all your bills have been paid. And if there are any investors, they've been repaid, and any lenders, they have been repaid. So you try to give as good a deal as you can get, as you get yourself. You don't have to give them a better deal necessarily unless there's a reason for doing that. So it's an issue that does come up, more and more, and usually has, you know, should be addressed, you know, obviously early in the process. Again, at this point, the documentary may be finished, and if they didn't sign their release, then God forbid. But or if you still want the cooperation of them of the subject, then it's something that obviously may need to be addressed. Well, basically, you just say it's too late.
Well, Bob, what I find often is that filmmakers are not aware of the term gross versus net, pre-tax net or after-tax net profits. And it's really important for people to know that if you give even 5% of your gross, that could be 70% of the money that's left over after expenses. So what is the net is always the concern that you should have. And I believe that filmmakers should only give away net, and then it's your choice, pre-tax net or after-tax net.
Well, it's basically if you give out profit participation, it should be calculated, defined, and paid in a manner probably that's the same as all other profit participants, including yourself, so that, you know, everybody's working on a level playing field.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what are life rights and what brings them?
As I mentioned previously, you don't necessarily need to get the life rights of a subject. If a subject has died, they basically don't have any defamation rights. They have no more privacy rights. That's why we like working with the dead, so to speak. excuse me. Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting all the cold.
Bless your heart.
But basically, if you know, there's also the issue of right of publicity, which is really more a right if you're putting someone's name or logo on their, on your T-shirt or merchandising. Again, the reason why you get a life rights for a particular subject is that, one, you want a waiver of any claim they may bring for defamation or invasion of privacy, because they're alive, and obviously that's possible, and or any other claims in general, other than unless it breaches the agreement, it is a breach in the actual agreement between the parties. But otherwise there should be a release. Second, it determines that if they're working with you, they really shouldn't be working with other, producers. And sometimes we put a period of time, like you can't work on another audiovisual project for, it could be 20 years, 10 years, 5 years, whatever, because the idea is, you've put money and time into this project, you want a chance to recoup your money or earn some money off of the project itself. And then it's really to get the access, not only to materials that the subject may have, but also the relationships that they have with other people so that they can help pave the way. So for a variety of those reasons, there's frequently a life rights agreement that could be secured.
Okay, that's very good. Thank you so much.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the hour, and I just wanted to ask you if you could just share a little bit about the filmmakers who would, there are filmmakers who would like to know what they can use under the fair use law.
Well, as I said, it's very much a facts and circumstances issue, and there's an analysis that you have to go through, such as, again, is this being used for a commercial or non-commercial reason? That's usually not very helpful, because you can say documentaries that you sell are commercial. It's really the amount of it that you're taking. The less you can take, the few seconds, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Also, how may this adversely affect the work itself that's being used? Again, if you take the heart, if you take the heart of a work, or some of the, or maybe it's a verse of music, and it's like for 10 seconds, it's like that's a pretty good amount of time. Count it out for yourself, and excuse me. And basically, and again, is it going to adversely affect, the marketplace for that, the work that you're appropriating? And most importantly, why is it being used? This is being used because if it's somebody's life, you're using, and they're an actor, you're using film clips to illustrate that. But again, you can't use film clips of like 30 minute, 2 minutes, something like that. So it's very facts and circumstance driven, and frequently when it comes to when a documentarian applies for errors and omission insurance, frequently that when the fair use defense is used, they will frequently ask for an attorney to render a legal opinion to explain why it fits within the criteria of fair use. So it's a very, very narrow and specific use,
mm-hmm.
and it has to be really for use other than just putting it into the project or avoiding getting licensing, paying a licensing fee.
Okay. Well, Bob, I know our listeners are going to want to know how to find you. What are the best ways to connect with you?
Well, my website is www.rls as in Sam, ENT as in Tom, LAW at AOL.com. And my phone number is 212-605-0300. Get over this.
Must be that flu that's been going around. Are you doing okay?
Yeah, so let me just give it again. 212-605-0301.
0301, got it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, very good.
Well, your show was marvelous. You just are a wealth of information. I know that, Mike.
Hope so.
Sincerely, thank you, and so do Claire and I.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, both of us, yes. Thank you so much, Bob. And take good care of yourself. I hope that clears up pretty soon.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye.
Take good care. Bye-bye. And also, I want to let our listeners know that we have more material with Bob Siegel. He's been on the show before. There's another brilliant show on Blog Talk here on the art of film funding in the archives that deals with creating your paperwork for features and docs. So I know that you will want to catch that as well. And Carol, it's been a great show.
Thank you, Claire. Same to you.
All right. Take care, everyone.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.